It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI. I'm Ann Strainchamps. Today, healing trauma. We've all read the headlines about post-traumatic stress disorder and how common it is among veterans. It's a huge mental health issue facing the country. But the truth is, it's not just veterans who suffer from PTSD. Nearly 1 in 10 Americans will develop it as a result of some kind of traumatic experience. So think about that. That's the population of Texas. Statistically speaking, you probably know someone who's had PTSD.
I was very much interested in danger and the beauty of violence. And I think as I spent more time in Iraq and saw more people wounded and saw the war not really improve, I began to question why I was interested in war and what that had done to my life.
David Morris spent 3 years reporting in Iraq before an IED explosion forced him to return home. In the years following, he says he was haunted by the memory of that attack. Something as simple as the sound of a garbage truck could send him into a full panic.
And this is what's sort of strange about PTSD is you find, and this is true for other veterans I've spoken to, is a lot of times something that will trigger you will not, you won't be able to exactly figure out why it's something that triggers you. And for some reason, and I don't know why, but dogs barking suddenly will really set me off.
David writes about his experience in his book, The Evil Hours. And one of the really interesting things about it is that he puts his own personal experience in a much bigger historic and national context. He really pushes us to rethink conventional explanations of PTSD.
I felt like everything that I heard in the media about it and that I heard from other people about it was simply a recapitulation of the symptoms, you know, hypervigilance, emotional numbing, and intrusive symptoms like nightmares and hallucinations. And to me, that was just a list, and it didn't get at the fullness of the story of PTSD, you know, the story that I think has been most richly told by novelists and poets and playwrights over history. I think the scientists are really behind the artists on this one. They're really just trying to catch up now.
So one of the things that's really interesting that you point out in the book is that it's not just veterans who suffer from PTSD, and that in fact there are possibly more PTSD survivors in this country who are victims of rape than who went through wartime.
That's absolutely correct. And that's one of the most important things to know about PTSD is that we heavily associate PTSD with the American veteran experience. But if you could, by magic, line up every person in the world that has PTSD right now, you would find that there are far more female rape survivors than there are military veterans. Rape is the most common and toxic form of trauma. And just by way of comparison, about 15 to 20% of American, say, Iraq veterans will develop PTSD as a result of their time in war. But about 50%, 49% of female rape survivors will develop PTSD. So it's approximately 3 times more psychologically toxic than war. You know, I wrote this book because people kept talking to me about PTSD, and I suffered from it for a while because I was a veteran. But if I'm being completely honest, PTSD is a, you know, it's a women's rights issue.
There's another way in which you look at it in the book as a whole, kind of on a national level. You know, for instance, you talk some about like the decades following the Civil War when so many people were walking around having been traumatized that you could say the entire country had PTSD.
If you look at the history of the Wild West and the degree of violence that permeated that part of American history, it is inextricable from the Civil War. You know, roughly 25% of the population, you know, had left the war and had no training outside of how to sleep on hard ground and how to fight and how to march. So you had a whole generation of people that had no economic skills, had no life skills outside of fighting.
So are you saying that those, the men of the old West, the Shanes and the famous cowboys and all that we mythologize, are you saying that when you actually look at their symptoms, they look a lot like PTSD survivors?
Yes. I mean, there's, I think if you look, if you consider the history of the Wild West and the violence that was not, the Wild West was certainly violent before, but the genocidal tactics of the U.S. Army emerged after the Civil War. The Colt revolver, the firearms that were used during the Civil War also helped create that culture of violence. I mean, it's sort of, if you think about it from just like a basic common sense standpoint, if when a young man is exposed and trained and lives for several years around firearms and violence, he tends to think of those things as acceptable behaviors.
You're really making me rethink the whole, you know, stereotype of the cowboy. I'm just thinking of all these loners, you know, who come into town a little jumpy, a little skittish, comfortable sleeping on the ground and only comfortable maybe with their horse.
Yeah, and it's interesting because that's that echo effect of PTSD. You can see it in a lot of other areas in American history. The homicide rate and non-negligent manslaughter rate went up 107% during the Vietnam War. You know, we are seeing an increase in violence right now in the wake of the Iraq and Afghanistan wars. The veteran suicide rate doubled after 2001, after these wars began. And researchers don't really have a solid understanding for this, but it appears to be when a large war begins, it conditions the populace at large to accept violence and killing and murder as an option for how they can resolve a situation. And a researcher at the University of California, Santa Cruz, Dane Archer, looked at major wars in Western history and found that in every case during a major war, there was always an increase in the criminality and the murder rate during that war.
So how long do you think it takes for a country to recover from war?
Well, I don't know if you do, frankly. I don't think it's something that you can never conclusively say is over. I mean, to use a very convenient example, you know, right now there's a large debate going on about the display of Confederate flags. Mm-hmm. You know, the Civil War ended in 1865. Here we are, you know, over 150 years later, still wrestling with this very central issue of how can we even, do we recognize this Confederate war imagery? Yeah, so, you know, one war, and in this very horrific and grisly way, one war often leads to the next.
There's another thing I wanted to ask you about, because you have this wonderful kind of big historical overview. So if we were living in ancient Greece or the Middle Ages or some other period of time, veterans came back from war with PTSD, how would they have been treated?
Well, the Greeks are an interesting example because the Greeks did not think of PTSD or anything like it as something that their medicine would speak to. Instead, what the Greeks did was use drama and use what they called catharsis to reenact and to publicly transmit the trauma of war so that the population would understand it. And ancient Greeks would stage plays that were written by veterans, enacted by veterans, and that was how they processed trauma, was through art. And
that's so interesting, also through sharing the experience, but sharing it publicly. The entire community took on the trauma rather than us sending individual veterans into isolated rooms with therapists to get over it and hoping the rest of the time they just won't talk about it.
Exactly. And that's what's really interesting is the Greeks were onto something in the sense of communalizing the trauma and having the whole society, and not just the local community, but the entire society was forced to confront what had just happened. And these were not nonfiction plays that were being told. They were fictionalized accounts that allowed people to feel the feelings and process the feelings openly and to weep in public.
There's a line you quote that really kind of stuck with me where you said, every era casts illness in its own image. So I'm curious, what is our own approach to trauma and PTSD say about us today?
Well, to characterize, I think, the modern American approach to PTSD is to talk about the medicalization of everyday life. And we do think about PTSD from a very specific medical model, and we think of it as treating symptoms as opposed to addressing the story, the particular narrative of a patient. Mm-hmm. And so what I take away from that is that we have medicalized what used to be the realm of poets, shamans, and priests. And so it shows how secular and how ahistorical and how scientific and how medical our approach is to this very existential event.
David Morris is a journalist and a former Marine. We were talking about his book, The Evil Hours, a biography of post-traumatic stress disorder. Some people get PTSD even though they haven't actually experienced trauma directly. They didn't personally survive an attack or an injury. Maybe they just heard about it. In 2011, Mac McClelland was reporting on sexual assault in Haiti. She interviewed all kinds of women who'd survived rape and other kinds of sexual assault, and just hearing their stories was traumatic. One day when she was driving, one of her sources looked out a window and recognized her attacker. The look on that woman's face triggered Mac's own panic. She tells Doug Gordon the story.
My reaction was that I dissociated. So I was like in the car doing my job, and I felt like I couldn't feel myself in my body. I felt like my actual existence was outside of my flesh. It's a very hard thing to describe, but I could see myself, like I was watching myself through a car window when I was actually the one in the car. And I was so dissociated from myself that like the sort of like ghost version of me outside the window was like, who are those people? And I was one of those people. So it's just a total disconnection from reality, basically. And it's extremely common in all kinds of trauma. People will very often do that. Not always, but it's a common response. It's your body's way of sort of protecting you from something that you can't handle and you really can't process at the time.
And it sounds incredibly surreal and troubling. And I imagine most people would have left the country immediately, but you didn't. Why?
Because I'm an idiot. I mean, you know, I just didn't know. That's the thing, is that we never talk about these things. So there's no part of me that was like, this is dissociation. That's a sign that I've been through something traumatic. I mean, I knew something was wrong, but I didn't know what, and I never could have guessed the true extent of it, because we just don't have any cultural knowledge about how trauma works.
And eventually, though, you did leave Haiti to return to the United States, and back at home, your symptoms just got worse.
Oh, yeah. Everything got way worse once I got home, because as bad as I was in Haiti with the crying and the nightmares, I wasn't sleeping, and, you know, I was self-medicating after work when I would get back to the hotel. I was still containing, in a way. Your body is, you know, it's made to survive. And so basically the second I got on the plane and it got like over America, I completely unraveled.
I was surprised to learn how complex PTSD actually is. It doesn't manifest itself simply as this extreme fear of depression, right? For you, it became this complicated cycle of emotions.
Sure. I would become so agitated that I would fantasize about ripping off my skin or ripping off my arms or stabbing myself in the chest. I mean, all sorts of hallucinations. And I had all manner of symptoms. One of the most surprising to me was I had a lot of sexual dysfunction, which, speaking of things that people never speak about, my God. I mean, I thought I was the only person in the world. Only now I know that that's extremely common, but there was basically no facet of my life that wasn't impacted in some way.
And there was this deeply physical component to your PTSD as well, besides the emotional numbness you experienced, which you've described as feeling like you were made out of cardboard. You were also physically numb.
Yeah, I would lose track of my limbs often, and parts of me would just like disappear. One time it was my whole torso, and that was sort of extra alarming to me. And you can't feel like you have any substance. And it's like, it feels like TV static or something has replaced your flesh and bones.
So was that terrifying to experience that kind of physical numbness, or did you see it as progress?
No, God, I hated that. It was awful. It's so disorienting to like look at your arms and know you have arms, but you can't feel your arms. And that's one of the things about post-traumatic stress disorder, and I think other emotional disorders as well, is it's not just that you have the symptoms, but on top of it, you have your feelings about those symptoms, which are like total panic often. And for me, looking back, I think my feelings about the symptoms were equally as bad, if not sometimes worse, than the actual symptoms themselves, because I just was constantly judging myself and feeling like I was weak and gross and a bad person because I just couldn't like snap out of it.
So you had like this kind of negative self-feedback loop going on.
Exactly. And it's not anybody's fault. It's not my fault that I felt that way. I mean, we're socialized to not be very empathetic and compassionate to people who just like can't get it together. Right? Like the stigma about mental illness in this country is enormous. And so once you've internalized that stigma, then you turn that stigma on yourself. And it's really debilitating and painful.
When it comes to PTSD, I think a lot of us think of it as this very individual experience. There's a profoundly traumatic event that you go through and that triggers the disorder. But it didn't really work out that way for you. In a way, you kind of almost inherited this trauma through someone else, which makes me wonder, is PTSD contagious?
Well, if you are in a house with a person who has post-traumatic stress disorder and have written about this, both in magazines and in the book, yeah, it does impact you. And there is a phenomenon called secondary trauma, where being around a traumatized person all the time can become traumatizing for you, which it sounds sort of weird when you just are kind of explaining it. But if you think about it, I mean, if you think about the impact of being around and being in a space with a person like that all the time, and you can sort of start to tiptoe around them, you know, because it's very unpredictable. So you don't know when they're going to be fine or when they're going to be set off. Of course, that can be traumatizing. If you really think concretely about what that looks like, it makes perfect sense.
Are there specific personality traits that make a person susceptible to PTSD?
I mean, everybody has been through traumas in their lives. Statistically, almost everyone has been through traumas in their lives. Like, you certainly have. I certainly was before this. Even if you don't think of it that way, you know, because you were fine and you moved on with your life. So you don't dwell on it. But it happens. The thing about post-traumatic stress disorder is that they think, yes, there are some factors. One of them is that you've been through trauma before. Could be that you have, like, no emotional support system. Like, having gone through trauma in your childhood is one of the big factors that contributes, they say, you know, to making you slightly more likely to be traumatized. But at the same time, even if you had none of those factors, you could still get post-traumatic stress disorder.
Hmm. How big a public health issue is PTSD?
Well, this has to be highly estimated, right? I mean, it's extremely hard to count. But if you say, you know, 7 to 9% of Americans have PTSD at any time, it's a fairly significant portion. But if you consider special circumstances and events, people who live in violent neighborhoods and who grew up in violent neighborhoods, their proportion is higher, of course. But if you think also after Hurricane Katrina, for example, there were points at which like a quarter of the population was suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. That's huge. If it was a disease, you know, if it was measles or something, I mean, that would be like a full-scale health epidemic.
Mac McClellan's memoir is called Irritable Hearts, a PTSD love story. She talked with Doug Gordon. Coming up, some good news about trauma. It can have an upside. I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. We're talking about trauma and how to heal it in this hour. And here's the good news. As isolating and painful as it is to live through trauma, new research suggests that in the long run, it can actually improve people's lives, sort of along the lines of what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. Journalist Jim Rendon makes the case in his new book, Upside, The New Science of Post-Traumatic Growth. He tells producer Raymond Tangekar that resilience in the face of trauma is actually a lot more common than you'd think.
The research shows that about half to two-thirds of trauma survivors report some level of post-traumatic growth. So it doesn't mean that you go through a traumatic experience and then you're just kind of happy-go-lucky. You know, there is a lot of suffering that goes on. Often people will have post-traumatic stress symptoms or PTSD. But from that suffering and that sort of terrible experience, people are kind of spurred to find something better in themselves or their lives. They look for more meaning. They may, you know, seek closer relationships or sort of look for a more spiritual experience. People have sort of different ways of responding to that that results in post-traumatic growth.
Is this a new way of looking at trauma?
It really is. The researchers that coined the term post-traumatic growth, I think they sort of first published that term in 95. And so when these two guys, Rich Tedeschi and Lawrence Calhoun, came up with this idea of post-traumatic growth, I think a lot of people in their field just looked at it and thought, that's not what we know about trauma. We know trauma is bad for you. So we are looking for ways in which it's bad for you and how to fix that. You know, what I've found that I find very interesting is I think almost every person that's published research on post-traumatic growth that I talk to, and that is many, many dozens. I don't even remember. I mean, maybe 100 people, a lot of people. You know, for them, the interest in this comes really from what they hear from their patients, that they hear about this phenomenon from cancer survivors and accident victims and combat veterans and, you know, a whole range of people that have been through all kinds of terrible experiences that have told them that, yes, you know, it was really bad. It was a terrible time. And, you know, I'm still miserable, but also I'm different. I'm somebody different than I was before.
Are there certain types of traumatic events that are more likely to trigger PTSD?
A lot of the researchers I spoke to about trauma really just say that a traumatic event is more about how you react to it than what the particular event is, and that everybody reacts differently to different events. You know, I would probably react very differently to a violent event than a combat veteran or a veteran cop who's been on the street for 20 years. You know, that what is traumatic is how it impacts you as opposed to what the exterior stimulus is that is being considered traumatic.
Well, you also write about the importance of narrative in interpreting trauma. Could you talk about how that affects growth?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, everybody sort of tells a story about who they are and what their lives are and what their lives can and can't be. And, you know, for a lot of trauma survivors, you know, trauma changes that. It may be a physical limitation. You may lose the use of your legs. You might have a brain injury that, you know, impairs you and suddenly you can't do the things you could do before. And so it forces you to find a new narrative. You know, a lot of people find that they are much stronger. They've been through something really horrific and, you know, have been through a lot of physical pain, a lot of psychological and emotional pain. And just getting through that makes them see that they are maybe a lot stronger than they realize. So trauma is one of those breakpoints in your life that really allows you to rewrite your own story, if you will.
Well, could you give me an example of how that plays out? I mean, you tell the story of Shane Mullins in the book. Could you talk about him?
Yeah, Shane is fantastic. He's a really remarkable young man. You know, he basically was a kind of young kid. He dropped out of school and was working at his parents' farm and bought a car and went out, got very, very drunk and wrecked the car and wound up with a traumatic brain injury that was pretty devastating. I mean, he had trouble communicating. He was partially paralyzed on one side of his body. And, you know, when he got out of the hospital, finally, he went home and just tried to pick up his old life and, you know, went out to the pub drinking and just was a disaster. And his family had to come pick him up from the pub. And, you know, he just was a mess. And at a certain point, he just kind of realized he needed to get sober. And so he went back into a sort of treatment facility. And there was a moment in there where he kind of saw that, you know, his old self just wouldn't work. The whole identity that he had of being this carefree kid, it just was gone. He couldn't do it anymore. And, you know, he finally decided to go back to school. He went to the small college in Galway. And he actually travels around Ireland. He gives a presentation to school kids and to, he's done, I think, done stuff on TV. And, you know, BBC did a short radio documentary about him. And, yeah, he's fantastic.
And that's what I find remarkable about all the stories in your book. I mean, it seems like a common refrain among a lot of these survivors is that, in a way, they're almost kind of grateful. I think you asked several of them if they do it again or go through that again, if they had a choice, and almost all of them said yes.
Yeah, I mean, it is amazing. I mean, so many of these people, it's that sense that, like, there was sort of no road to here but the road I took, you know, and that they're so happy to be where they are in terms of just their lives and what they're doing, that the sacrifice was worth it.
Does this change or challenge in any way the way we currently think about treating trauma?
I think so. I think it really does. And I think, you know, because now I think the way we treat trauma is really focused on just getting you functional, you know, and that's hugely important, not to dismiss that, but it shouldn't really stop there. And, you know, there are a lot of different approaches to it, but kind of gearing it towards positive change and sticking with people and keeping them engaged and helping them find communities where, you know, they can be of value to themselves and to other people is really important.
G. Jim Rendon's book, Upside, The New Science of Post-Traumatic Growth, will be out in August. Raymond Tunkekar talked with him. It can take years to recover from trauma, even a lifetime. And the standard treatment is therapy, which usually means a lot of talking. But what if you spent hours and hours talking? You've told your story to therapists and support groups, and you still feel bad. Psychiatrist Bessel van der Kolk is a pioneer in the field of trauma research. In his work, and in his book, The Body Keeps the Score, he focuses on the physical effects of trauma. He told Steve Paulson that for some survivors, getting back in touch with the body is the key to healing.
Well, we are our bodies, and in our culture, we forget it. We are animals, and so if we get scared or we're threatened, we secrete stress hormones to get us out of the way to fight back. And if we are trapped, immobilized, can't do anything, those stress hormones keep pounding your body to run and to move and keep you in a state of great agitation. But that agitation then becomes a divorce from the original idea, and your body continues to stay in a constant state of threat.
So how does trauma affect our senses, how we respond to the world?
Well, trauma causes our senses to become firstly hyper-acute, very reactive to sounds and lights and touch and various physical stimuli. And then as this goes on, the body sort of desperately tries to calm that down. Many people use drugs, alcohol, to try to do that. Actually, it's probably the single most important cause of drug addiction and alcoholism is a traumatized body that tries to calm itself down. Many people manage to do that without alcohol or drugs, and they just shut off their relationship to their body. One of the effects of trauma, maybe, is that you go through life feeling like a zombie.
Well, you tell a fascinating story in your book of a patient you call Sherry, who was getting a foot massage and apparently had some startled reaction when she realized that the therapist had her hands on her feet.
Yeah, it's really very startling to me also to discover the degree to which traumatized people have a very distorted relationship to their bodies. Feel nothing. That whole part of their bodies basically are missing.
How could they not? I mean, if someone is massaging your feet, how could you not feel that?
All you need is to shut down your perceptual system in your brain, and you don't feel it. Like, and your brain just learns how to shut down those sensations. All these strange reactions start off as ways in which people try to defend themselves and deal with the horror that's happening to them. But if it continues, then it makes you very ill-equipped to deal with daily life. And this is very much what happens with soldiers, for example, is that your brain gets reorganized to deal with threat. But you become very oblivious to anything else. Hmm. Nothing means anything to you but the very thing that has caused you pain. And so you get this strange paradox. People get really trapped in that in a terrible way.
Yeah. So what do you do when you see people like this who come in to see you looking for help?
Well, I think most of all, you need to wake yourself up to the present. It's very useful to do things that make people feel alive in the present in their bodies, like singing. We do a lot of yoga. I think martial arts might be helpful. Anything that makes your body feel alive right now, but that's not connected with the trauma per se, so you don't reactivate all the same old circuits again.
Well, you've also done a lot of work with EMDR, eye movement desensitization and reprocessing. Could you explain how that works?
Well, a very strange technique. About 25 years ago, Francine Shapiro discovered that if you move your eyes back and forth while you think about a very bad event, that event sort of calms itself down. And that eventually became EMDR. And actually, I did some National Institute of Health funded research on that method, being quite skeptical about it initially. And we had fantastic results, actually.
Just moving your eyes back and forth as you're thinking about this traumatic
happened? As you call up the memories, what you saw, what you heard, what you smelled, what you felt in your body, what you were thinking, and you move your eyes from side to side, something starts shifting. And what it looks like happens here is it's very similar to what happens when you dream, when you also move your eyes back and forth. It consolidates memories and attaches us to other things that's happened in your life. When you get traumatized, a number of different brain circuits and brain regions that you need to put an event behind you go offline. When you're so hyper-aroused and terrified in a state of horror, that capacity of the brain to integrate the event, to be able to say, it's over, you know, it was really awful, but now I'm back with my family, I'm back home, and I'm okay. That capacity is interfered with, and it seems like EMDR is one method by which you can bring those brain regions online that you need in order to make a differentiation between things happening now and things having happened a long time ago.
If I were to come into your office, what would you do? How would you do that with me sitting right there?
First of all, I want to get to know you a little bit, so we feel somewhat comfortable with each other. And then I'd say, become very quiet and just say, just sit in your chair and evoke the scene of what happened back then. And I don't ask you to talk about it. One of the great problems with verbal therapy is that the moment you start talking about these terrible things, your body tends to get hijacked and to feel like it's happening all over again. So one of the important things here is to be very quiet and to say, just notice in your mind what happened back then. And then you ask people to go into these eye movements. My hunch is that in hypnosis you can do the same thing, but very few people are doing hypnosis anymore these days. But you go into sort of a trance state. And in the trance state, you can sort of rework that memory, and it becomes a memory. Because in the culture, people talk about trauma as an event that happened a long time ago. But in fact, what the trauma is the imprints that that event has left on your mind and in your sensations. The discomfort you feel and the agitation you feel and the rage and the helplessness that is happening right now. And so it's all located in the landscape of your body.
That's remarkable.
It is remarkable.
Yeah. It sounds like you're saying that by doing this, you are kind of draining the emotion out of those memories. I mean, it's not as if you're erasing the memories, but you're sort of turning them into normal memories again.
You're turning them into, and that's what we see and that we can document actually in our research, is that before we do these things, people see it, they hear it, they feel it in their bodies, very overwhelmed by it. And after it's over, they say, yeah, this is what happened back then on March 3rd, 1948 or whenever. And I was a little kid and now I'm a different person now.
Wait, are you saying just after one session of EMDR this can happen?
No. It depends on many different things. The more acute the trauma is, the more efficiently this works. For example, a number of my colleagues saw people who were affected by the Boston Marathon. And within one or two sessions, just it became like, boy, I went through a really bad experience, but I'm safe now. And I see this in my office quite a bit. It's a very gratifying to see people just come to life and say, hey, I'm alive. Thank you very much. They shake your hand and walk out. Okay. But you know,
it's a little hard to believe.
It's hard, a little bit hard to believe, and it's almost too good to be true. But this is what we see in acute trauma quite a bit.
Have you tried EMDR yourself?
I've tried everything I do. So I do many different methods, EMDR. I'm a great fan, advocate, researcher of yoga. Yoga is a great way of helping people to get in touch with their body, feeling alive in their body, regulate their physiological arousal.
Are these kinds of practices, are they good for everyone?
Well, you know, if you don't have PTSD, I see no reason to do EMDR. But yoga, I think I'm a better person for doing it. I think I'm quieter, more mindful, more tolerant. It's very interesting that the whole culture is, we start off in a Western tradition. The Western tradition is yakking and drugs.
Well, the Western tradition has sort of cut the mind off from the body, right?
Right. There's also a deep belief that as long as you can talk, things will get better. And talking can be enormously important, but it's very interesting to go to China and India and Japan and to see that they have long traditions doing Qigong, Tai Chi, yoga. And it's very clear to me that those methods were all invented in those cultures to help people with trauma.
It's kind of amusing to hear a psychiatrist talking about the limits of yakking, of talk therapy.
Well, of course, there's much more extreme people in my profession who believe that you should only give people drugs. No, I think talking is important, but most importantly, befriending yourself, allowing yourself to feel what you feel, and becoming safe in your body is the most important thing in overcoming trauma.
Psychiatrist Bessel van der Kolk is the author of The Body Keeps the Score, Brain, Mind, and Body in the Healing of Trauma. He and Steve also talked quite a bit about yoga and trauma. You can hear the rest of their conversation on our website at ttbook.org. We're going to take a quick break, but coming up, anthropologist Nina Jablonski explains the science of skin color. It's to the best of our knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. And now, bookmarks, writers on books they love.
I am Ulipis, author of On Immunity, and I would love to recommend The Argonauts by Maggie Nelson. This is an extraordinary book. It's part memoir, and it's part philosophical. The personal story in this book is fairly light. This isn't a narrative-driven book. It isn't driven by plot. It is driven by its characters, and its characters are dazzling. The main character, of course, is the narrator, Maggie Nelson, who, over the course of the book, becomes pregnant and gives birth and begins raising a young child. The other character is her partner and lover, Harry Dodge, the artist. And over the course of this book, Harry transitions in some ways from female to male, but there's a great quote from Harry in there where he says, "I'm not on my way anywhere." His insistence is not on becoming a man after having been a woman, but on being kind of neither and both, being in between. And he identifies as being somewhere between genders. And this is a really important part of the philosophical examination of the book, is what it means to allow yourself to dwell in a space between. Maggie Nelson really celebrates this in-betweenness or bothness, the and rather than the but, through the entire book. What I love about the book is that it offers an attitude that I think is a beautiful attitude to try on, be inside for a while. An attitude towards the self, but an attitude towards the world that's, I think the best description of it is just deeply generous. Reading this book made me come out the other side feeling better about myself and the world, which is not how I always feel after I finish reading a book that I love. But this book was truly happy-making, in part because part of what Maggie Nelson is doing in this book, in The Argonauts, is giving herself permission to be happy. And I think that we forget sometimes that we need to do that, that we need to give ourselves permission. But in giving herself permission, she also gives permission to everyone who's listening in on her thinking, to feel what she's feeling and to be freed to some extent from, I don't know what to call it, I guess a kind of social prison.
Ulipis recommends The Argonauts by Maggie Nelson. You'll find more bookmarks and an interview with Biss on our website at ttbook.org. One of the first things you notice when you meet someone new is the color of their skin. Somehow this one physical trait has become so important to us and so loaded with issues and assumptions about race and identity. Just the other week, people all over the country were debating the case of Rachel Dolezal. She's the former NAACP president in Spokane. And remember, she was outed as white, even though for years she's claimed to be black. So were people arguing about the shade of her skin or about her racial identity? In other words, is race an inherited biological trait, or is it just a social construct? Skin turns out to be pretty fascinating. Anthropologist Nina Jablonski studies the history and biology of skin color, and she told Steve Paulson it goes all the way back to early human history and our emergence as the first naked ape.
We can estimate that humans firstly evolved naked skin, probably around 1.5 million years ago, and at the same time they mostly lost their coat of fur, they evolved permanent dark pigmentation. And basically what that dark pigmentation did was take the place of fur as a UV sunscreen.
So this was in Africa where this happened. I mean, the earliest humans evolved in Africa. So why did we lose our fur? I mean, why did we develop this naked skin?
This is a very good question. We think that it occurred because of the need to keep ourselves cool. These individuals were tall, strapping, strong walkers, vigorous runners, and all those activities taking place under equatorial sun generate a lot of heat. So we evolved the ability to sweat copiously, probably around 1.5 million years ago, and lost most of our fur at the same time.
So these early humans then basically were naked. They were in equatorial Africa and developed dark skin as protection against the sun?
That's right. And most animals protect themselves from ultraviolet radiation with their fur. So what we did in our lineage was turn on pigmentation genes that allowed us to produce more permanent pigmentation in our skin cells. And this was really an important revolution in human history.
Now, was the main problem that if we didn't have this melanin to protect us against the sun, that we were going to develop skin cancer?
Probably that wasn't the main problem, although certainly ultraviolet radiation can lead to skin cancer. This rarely occurs in individuals during their reproductive years. And so when we think about evolutionary mechanisms, we have to think about the reproductive years. So as I was struggling with this more than 20 years ago, I realized that ultraviolet radiation has the ability to break down an essential B vitamin called folate, something that we get from green vegetables and citrus fruits and whole grains. Folate is really important for making DNA and new cells. And it turns out that ultraviolet radiation has the ability to seriously damage folate. And the key insight behind our research is that protective melanin pigmentation evolved primarily not to protect us from skin cancer, but to preserve our folate so that we could reproduce successfully.
So given all of these advantages of dark skin, why doesn't everyone have dark skin today?
Well, for most of human history, we did. What we see today is the product of the dispersal of a few human populations out of Africa around 60 to 70,000 years ago. These ancestors of modern Eurasians were beginning to disperse into parts of the world that had much lower UV levels, and they run into problems if they have too much natural sunscreen. And the reason is that some UV is absolutely essential to us for making vitamin D in the skin.
Why do we need the vitamin D?
Vitamin D is essential for us to absorb calcium and phosphorus from our diet. So we need vitamin D to make a strong skeleton, but we also need vitamin D to maintain a strong functioning immune system. And basically, we have vitamin D receptors on every important organ of our bodies.
Now, there is also a whole racial component to this discussion. I mean, we tend to separate people by skin color into different races. You are a scientist. How should we understand race scientifically?
Well, I think it's important to understand it from a few different perspectives. When we look at human genetic diversity, we can see there are no clean breaks between human populations. So we see sort of rough and ready kinds of biological groupings, but there's tremendous amounts of overlap. There are no clear demarcation lines. And this is the primary reason why geneticists decades ago said there are no human races from a biological perspective.
So race is strictly a social construction.
Yes. But we have to recognize that that doesn't make it any less real. It doesn't really matter about the philosophical status of the race concept. If people identify that they belong to a particular race, it's real for them.
But it would seem also that there are some physical differences between races. I mean, for instance, if we look at the world of sports, people of West African origin dominate the world-class sprinting events.
This has a very interesting implication. Would you put West Africans in a separate race? Most people wouldn't, because they have so much tremendous overlap of their biological characteristics with people from other parts of Africa, including East Africa, where people have tremendous abilities in long-distance running and marathon running and not in sprinting. So drawing a definite sort of line of demarcation becomes impossible. And also, if you're just looking at a characteristic like running ability, sprinting ability, it also requires tremendous amounts of training. So there's a huge cultural component to it.
Well, we should talk some about this cultural history, because certainly one of the most disturbing developments throughout the course of human history is that blackness has been stigmatized. Around the world for centuries, people of darker skin color have been seen as socially inferior. Can we date this as to when this started?
Yes, we can. This becomes really potent in Europe, beginning in the 16th, 17th, and then in a significant way in the 18th century. So this isn't something that we can trace to very, very ancient times, but rather mostly associated with the growth of the transatlantic slave trade. It becomes very important in the history of colonial mercantilism that we actually be able to have a workforce to help develop many colonial lands. And so, well, let's get some slaves. Now, it's very important that if you're going to take slaves, that you basically create slaves as an inferior class.
Basically, you have to dehumanize them to be able to enslave them.
Yes, you dehumanize them by saying they are inherently black, inherently immoral, inherently incapable of developing true human qualities. They are subhuman.
And there were some very influential thinkers who played up these racial differences. Linnaeus, the 18th century scientist who developed modern taxonomy, distinguished between four human races and attributed various temperaments to each. The philosopher Kant talked about the different races of humanity, and not surprisingly, he put the white Europeans at the top as the most talented race. I mean, these were among the people who laid the foundations for the modern world.
And the fact that Linnaeus was read by Kant, and that many, many people read Kant, including Thomas Jefferson and many other thinkers who were important in the formation of our own country, read Kant, and this becomes the most toxic combination in human history. So that you have blackness associated with base qualities and subhuman status as less able to generate a complex civilization as Kant would have it.
Now, these days, much has changed, and pale skin is clearly not as prized as it once was. How do you see the politics of skin color in the world today?
We live in a very strange world where many light-skinned people want to be darker, at least tanned, to look healthy and to look like they have just enjoyed a vacation on the Riviera. A lot of darkly pigmented people want to look lighter because lightness is associated with higher status. So we have a very paradoxical situation. I think what we need to recognize is that humans are motivated to want an appearance that confers higher status. Once we recognize that that's a pretty stupid thing to do, we can adjust our cultural sights and say, hey, let's just live with the skin color that we have. Let's cherish and protect it as it is.
Nina Jablonski is an anthropologist at Penn State and the author of Living Color, The Biological and Social Meaning of Skin Color. If you like this conversation, you should read Steve's longer interview with her, just published in Nautilus magazine. You'll find the link on our website at ttbook.org. And hey, while you're there, sign up for the podcast, because To the Best of Our Knowledge can be a great companion on a car ride, a commute, while you're waiting in line. Think of it as knowledge on demand. To the Best of Our Knowledge comes to you from Madison, Wisconsin, and the studios of Wisconsin Public Radio. Raymond Tungekar produced today's show, with help from Doug Gordon, Craig Ely, Charles Monroe Kane, and Emma Raskowski. Our theme music comes from Steve Mullen from Walk West Music. Kirill Owen is our technical director. Steve Paulson is our executive producer. And I'm Ann Strainchamps. Thanks for listening.
PRI, Public Radio International.